Hi, everybody. Welcome back to All Crime, No Cattle. This is the Texas True Crime Podcast that is hosted by your favorite two Texas natives, one of them being myself, Detective Shea Butter, and the other sits across from me, a hired gun, a dangerous desperado, set out to get the bounty on a wanted poster for justice. The one, the only, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hi, guys.
Very underwhelming from that introduction I gave you.
Hi, guys.
Whoa, why'd you...
Desperado, me. It's me. Oh, man.
Well, what we got going for you today is a brand new episode. We're episode 27, I believe, correct?
I think so. And sounds about right.
So we have two announcements for you. Kick us off, Aaron.
Well, our very first one is a thing that we've been touting for a couple episodes now, and that is going to be our big donation drive for Texas EquiSearch. So this is something that we've been running for a couple of weeks now. We're doing a huge raffle along with a bunch of other podcasts who have nicely decided to join this powerhouse of a donation drive that we've all started.
So how does it work?
Well, this is how it works. So Texas EquiSearch is this really fantastic nonprofit organization. They subsist pretty much mainly on donations. Their donations are very low right now, so we are trying to head up a donation drive with all of you guys, all of the true crime listeners. We know that you guys are interested in this kind of thing, and Texas EquiSearch is a really excellent organization. They have worked in countless cases with missing persons. They do missing person searches on horseback, so in a lot of areas where it's hard to get a vehicle in there, hard to get people out there and searching, and they work everywhere, not only in Texas, but they have worked across the nation, and they've also worked abroad. It's a really excellent organization. And so this fundraiser is something that I think is really important. And it's easy as pie. Go to their website or go to our Facebook page. It is the pinned post right now. If you just click on that link to donate $5, you're going to be entered into our raffle, which is a raffle of ACNC merch. You get a t-shirt, you get a coffee mug or a water bottle, and you get a bunch of stickers, and you get our thanks because you're a beautiful, wonderful person. If you decide that you have a little bit more money to spend, and if you donate $20 or more, you get entered into the big mega raffle, which is a raffle where you have the chance to win a ton of merch from a bunch of different places that are amazing. And so all you have to do is go make your donation, send us the receipt, or you can take a screenshot of your receipt if that's easier for you, and send it over our way at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com, or you can even Facebook message us if that's easier for you. Whatever you need to do to get that information to us, and then you will be entered into the raffle. It's as easy as that.
Well, yeah, it's an awesome cause. You should totally go do it. Jump in. We're running it for how much longer? A couple more weeks?
Yeah, it's going to be a few more weeks. I think we're going to probably end it and pick the winners mid-August, is what I'm thinking. And remember, just a $5 donation is something that's going to help Texas EquiSearch. And it's also going to get you entered into our raffle, which is really cool.
Our next thing we want to really start pushing in the next couple of episodes, because we're at the end of July. So you know what that means. We're about a month away from the Texas Podocalypse round two, coming to you from Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
The first one was really awesome. It was a lot of fun. This second one looks like there's going to be a ton more people. We've got like 24 shows that are going to show up. We've got shows from all over the place. Everything you need to know about this event, we have on our Facebook page. It's one of the previously pinned posts, but you can find it in our posts. It's going to be on Saturday, August 25th at 7 p.m. till whenever we decide to bring the cows home, as we say. We're going to have lots of
We literally do not and have never said
We've
that.
Always said it oh in time God. Memoriam. And this one looks like we're going to have a ton of people show up, too. There's a lot of people interested. Almost 100 people have said they're interested in showing up.
I know. We're going to shut that place down. Yeah. And call the authorities on us.
Yeah. It's supposed to be one of the best margarita place in Austin. We're drinking margaritas right now as we speak in celebration of our future margaritas a month from now with you guys, the fans. Anyways, yeah, if you want to go check it out, check out the event page. It's going to be at Rio Rita, August 25th. And with no further ado, are you ready to get into episode 27?
I'm ready.
What's it called, Aaron? Hit us.
This is the case of the elusive bank robber, Cowboy Bob.
Cowboy Bob.
So this is the bank robber who robbed multiple times throughout the Dallas area. So we will be all around Dallas this episode, but not actually in Dallas this week. So if you live in or know of a Dallas suburb, chances are that's going to come up in this episode. Mm. So we're going to be in a lot of different little cities around Dallas this week. And this is the very first case we've covered so far on the show where there is actually not a murder per se.
Mm.
So this one's going to be a little lighter than most. And I think that's a lucky break for all of us, I'm sure. Well, this is another one of those cases where there is pretty much a single main source, and that is the 2005 Texas Monthly article, The Last Ride of Cowboy Bob, written by, who do you think, Shay?
Gary Cartwright.
No.
Hmm.
Your second guess?
Well, if it's not Gary Cartwright, it has to be Skip Hollinsworth.
That's right. The great Skip Hollinsworth. And this article came out shortly after this case ended, for lack of a better word. So from what I can gather, this case was published about a lot while these events were taking place. This is all throughout the early 90s. So kind of before the internet was a real thing. And then once Skip's article came out in 2005, that has since been used as the go-to source for information about this case. So when you research this case, you get Skip Hollinsworth's article, and then maybe a few other things based wholly on his article, and that's pretty much it. There's not even a Wikipedia page on this case, which seems really unusual for as incredible as this story is. So definitely go check out that article. You can find it online. It's a really fantastic read, as per usual, when it comes to Skip Hollinsworth and pretty much anything that's ever published in Texas Monthly. It's a really great magazine.
Yeah, and recently I know they're archiving a bunch of their materials into audio format.
Yeah, I've noticed that. You actually can get this as an audio, as I guess an audio book is what you can call it, audio magazine article.
Yeah.
And it does actually cost you to do that, but I think it's just a couple bucks. So that's also an option if you'd rather do it that way.
And I've heard they're done really well, so check that out.
Yeah, there you go. Well, on to the case. In May of 1991, a man walked into the American Federal Bank in Irving, a suburb to the west of Dallas. When greeted by a bank teller, he handed her a handwritten note. The note read, "This is a bank robbery. Give me your money. No marked bills or dye packs." The teller handed the man all the cash in her drawer. The man nodded and walked out of the building. So the FBI were called in, and they began to review the surveillance tapes and interview employees about the robbery. And they noticed several things about this mysterious man. First was his overall look. He was a little older, he had a bit of a belly, and a heavy beard. He wore khaki pants, a dark shirt, a brown leather jacket, and black gloves. The jacket and gloves were especially odd, as this was May. A leather jacket and gloves is not appropriate for late springtime in Texas.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
He also wore sunglasses and a large white cowboy hat. He basically looked like an extra from some bad spaghetti western movie. But I have to be honest with you guys, all you non-Texans out there, this isn't exactly a weird look.
True.
For Texans. The "I just came from the ranch" look is pretty strong still, even today. And besides the unseasonable jacket and gloves, this wasn't really someone who you would look at twice.
No. And depending on the area where you were at, like if you were down in the stockyards, you'd see this look all the time.
All the time, for sure. Yeah. So this is suburbs Dallas. I'm not sure.
Maybe a little weird for there.
Maybe a little bit strange, but again, probably nothing that you would even think twice about. The FBI also noticed a few other things about the robber that perplexed them. The man was stone cold during the entire short exchange. He didn't look nervous or restless. He didn't look around for guards or police, even while he was waiting for the money. He kept his head down, and that, combined with the sunglasses and cowboy hat, meant that he was hard for bank employees to describe, and it meant that the surveillance cameras really didn't get a good shot of him.
Oh, because they're probably up high by the ceiling, and he's got this big wide brim cowboy hat on, plus the sunglasses and the beard, like you said.
So yeah, so he's wearing all this stuff to really obscure his face, and there are shots of him that I will be sure to share. You guys can see those online. But again, you know, it's hard to see. Surveillance cameras aren't, you know, perfect HD cameras as it is. So when he has this hat on, sunglasses, beard, blah, 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 it's hard to really get a good look at what this guy actually looks like.
Plus, I'm imagining this is grainy 90s surveillance camera footage we're talking about.
Yeah, you're right. He also didn't speak a word, so employees couldn't even describe what his voice sounded like. He didn't appear to have a weapon and didn't threaten anyone with one, and he didn't seem to have any partners in the crime. And his notes specify that he was aware of them slipping marked bills and dye packs into the stacks of money that he stole, which are both security measures banks use to foil robbers. Wow. So he was obviously aware of these things that banks use and was like, hey, don't put that into the sacks of money I'm stealing from you.
Yeah, he seems like a very experienced bank robber.
Exactly.
I never thought about the handing a note to the teller as a way of them not being able to describe your voice. I don't know why, but I've never thought about it that way. I always thought it was just like a subtle thing, but that makes more sense that it's giving them less clues to identify you later.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's all of those things. It's to be subtle. It's to be quiet, to not make a scene. So nobody else can describe you besides that one teller who you're having this interaction with. But it's also like nobody can even describe something as simple as your voice. So it's definitely a way to disguise who you are. So let's pause here and talk about dye packs, because first, this is going to be important to the rest of the story. But second, you always see these being used in TV and film. And in that one case, the Nine Inch Nails music video for Deep, where they have those really weird dye packs that explode and then they're all like making out in the dye and it's really weird.
Oh, that happens? Oh, okay.
It happens.
I immediately thought of the Raising Arizona scene with John Goodman and his the guy who's playing his brother in that scene when the dye packs explode in the car and they can't see out the windshield and they wreck their car.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. So how do these kind of dye packs actually work? It turns out it's actually really super interesting technology. So dye packs are actually inserted into a stack of money that is being used as a decoy. The stack is literally hollowed out and the dye pack is placed inside. So when you look at it, it looks like a regular stack of money. Now, the packs themselves used to be quite rigid. So if you handled the stack, it was fairly easy to tell that there was something inside of it. But now these dye packs are built so that they're flexible. So when you handle the stack of money, it doesn't feel any different than a regular stack of money. So in order for you to detect it, you'd have to sit there and flip through each stack of cash that you're trying to steal in order to ensure that you don't get a decoy with a dye pack inside, which is obviously going to be hard to do in the middle of your bank robbery.
Yeah, it's kind of a built-in countermeasure, because the only way to defend against it is if you did, like you said, flip through each stack, and that's going to take time and effort, and that leads to more people being apprehended because you want to get out of there as quick as possible.
That's right. So these decoys with the dye packs are kept with the rest of the money, but they are attached to magnetic plates that keep them dormant. So when a bank is being robbed, the employee will try to slip in one of these decoys from the plate in with the rest of their money that they're handing over.
Oh, is this like in a hidden area, like where they're working?
Exactly. So you have a drawer full of money, and at least it's my understanding that the decoys are kept with the rest of the money. So it's not like you're going, yes, wait a second, please, and you're going to where the decoys are kept in another area. It's kept there with the money, and the tellers are aware of which packs are the decoy packs.
Yeah, you're just making a conscious effort to grab that one that you normally would never grab.
Yeah, that's right. So when one of the decoys is removed from that magnetic plate, a radio receiver within the dye pack becomes engaged, but the dye pack doesn't yet explode. Mounted on all entrances and exits to the bank are radio transmitters. So when the decoy passes through an exit, that transmitter will send a radio signal to the receiver in the dye pack, which will then activate the dye pack, but it still doesn't yet explode. And that's because they're usually set on a delay, something like 10 to 20 seconds or so that the dye pack doesn't explode until the person is well on their way with the stolen cash or is even in the getaway car.
Oh, so like the one in Raising Arizona was a really long delay because they were minutes down the road talking, having a good time, and then all of a sudden, bam, and it just explodes all inside the car and they wreck.
Yeah, exactly. It's probably not going to be set on a delay that's that long. It's usually just a few seconds to ensure that the person has left the building and they're out and they're now focused on escaping. And then bam, that dye pack explodes.
Man, I bet that is such calamity and chaos for a bank robber, like when that happens.
It's actually quite incredible. You can find YouTube videos, which I looked at some YouTube videos just to see what this looks like. It's literally an explosion of color coming from them. I mean, it's apparent what's going on.
Oh, man.
It's very crazy. So definitely go check those out on YouTube.
Man, I bet that makes the wheels fall off so fast.
It does. Absolutely. Well, when that dye pack finally explodes, it releases a combination of red dye, which is used to stain the robber's clothes and skin, as well as the stolen money, and or a aerosol of red smoke. So like we were talking about, it's this huge explosion of dye and smoke and it gets everywhere. And it's like, hello, I just robbed a bank. And obviously that's meant to signal to authorities and onlookers and eyewitnesses that
this guy smoking red.
Exactly. The dye packs can also carry tear gas in some cases, which I didn't know. Yeah. So that's obviously meant to stun and disarm the robbers.
That's horrible.
It's really crazy. So at this point, you might be like, okay, just grab the smoking, sputtering dye pack out of the bag and then toss it and keep running with the rest of the money. The thing is, the chemical reaction from the explosion in the dye pack burns so hot. It's around 400 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 200 degrees Celsius. And it makes it really hard to do. Basically, you're not going to be able to handle that decoy immediately after it explodes, or it's going to burn the crap out of you.
So you need like leather gloves or something on to even
grab
it. Okay.
Yeah. So essentially, your options are now to either keep the money, which is probably close to useless at this point because it's stained with this dye that is traceable by the FBI. And marks it as being money that has been stolen from a bank.
Come to think of it, I've never run across a single dollar bill or
with this red dye on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
If you had one just that had slipped into your money somehow, like if you'd gotten it from a convenience store getting change or whatever, would a bank not take it, or would like people be able to refuse it, I guess?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know what happens if you were to try to actually spend money with the red dye on it. I'm assuming that a bank is going to know this is potentially a problem. I think essentially what the issue is, this dye is traceable by the FBI. So even if you cleaned the dye off, even if you bleached the actual cash and removed the dye, that the trace of this chemical is still there.
Wow.
So they can actually still trace it. So if you go out and spend a ton of money that has been marked with this dye, it can still lead back to you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can go buy probably a Snickers bar at the gas station with, you know, the $5 bill that's marked with a red dye, and they might take it.
But if the FBI got their hands on it, they could get back to you.
And so, I think that's kind of the issue.
Is the FBI?
You're then spending money that is traceable back to you.
Is the FBI the one manufacturing all of these dyes?
No, it seems like it's an actual commercial.
But they make them to FBI specifications. So
I suppose so. I think it's just basically this one commercial company that makes almost all of these dye packs.
I did not know any of this. This is interesting.
Isn't it interesting? Yeah. I thought it was interesting. So yeah, you have the option of trying to take the money and trying to spend it as best you can, or you can then, because remember, it's smoking and you are leaving a trace of yourself behind as you smoke down the street or down the highway, you can decide to leave the money behind. And so that's what actually most people do, and it leads to the recovery of the money in most cases. So they've actually recovered, I think I've seen a stat of like $20 million is what they've recovered this way by these dye packs, and then people just being like, and then just toss it out the window or whatever, and then they're able to get the money back. So
but
at that point,
usable,
then,
though, right?
Well, they get the money back, and then they can just reprint it. I don't know, baby. Stop asking me all these questions.
Okay, I thought you had the answers.
No. Okay. So then at that point, you have no money, and you're covered in red dye. And congratulations on your life choices, because, it's just a terrible situation for you.
Everyone who sees you running by smoking and in red dye is just going to be like, you went that way.
Yeah, absolutely. So back to our story. The getup this robber was wearing led the FBI agent Steve Powell to coin him as Cowboy Bob. Steve Powell had worked bank robbery investigations for the Dallas office of the FBI for like 30 years at this point. And after this investigation, he and other agents were sure that this man was a professional bank robber. What Steve Powell and the rest of the FBI team didn't know was that this was actually Cowboy Bob's very first bank robbery, but it certainly would not be his last.
That's amazing that this is his first bank robbery, because like we said, he went about it like an expert.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really weird.
Interesting. So Steve Powell is on the prowl for Cowboy Bob.
That's right.
On his first job.
Oh, dang. Yeah, bam, bam. Exactly. But now, you know, we have to be clear, though. This is definitely the strongest assumption that it is Cowboy Bob's first bank robbery. We don't absolutely know that for sure, but that's something that we're going to get into later. But yeah, 7 months later, in December of 1991, Cowboy Bob struck again, this time at the Savings of America Bank, also in Irving. The robbery pretty much went the same way as the first, with Cowboy Bob calmly and coolly entering the building, handing over the note, waiting patiently for the cash, this time a total of $1,258. He even wore the same outfit. But this time, he was spotted getting into a brown 1975 Pontiac Grand Prix, and a concerned citizen had even been able to write down the license plate. The FBI traced the number to an address of a house nearby. The woman who lived there was thoroughly confused when she opened up the door to the FBI asking her about a bank robbery and showed them to her car, only to discover that the license plates were missing. Yeah, so now we know that Cowboy Bob was taking the added precaution of stealing license plates to swap out on his own car in order to make him essentially untraceable. Another smart move of an apparent professional.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. It really is. It's that's like some James Bond stuff where you see the license plate flip, you know, in the car.
Yeah. The very next month, in January of 1992, Cowboy Bob stole $3,000 from Texas Heritage Bank in Garland, a suburb northeast of Dallas and about half an hour away from the previous robberies in Irving.
That's a bigger bank. That's one I've heard of.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You've heard about this bank?
Uh-huh.
Well, just 4 months after that, he hit Nations Bank in Mesquite. And Mesquite is known as the rodeo capital of Texas, if you didn't know.
The rodeo capital?
That's what I read. Mesquite is about 20 minutes south of Garland. So we're all kind of in the same area, but all still suburbs of Dallas.
I like to call that one Mesquite.
You do. I don't know why you do.
You know, what's also great with Mesquite is the wood. Mesquite wood. Yeah, it's great for barbecuing.
At this robbery, he walked away with a cool $5,317.
I like that flourish you did there. Cool.
Now, during this robbery in Mesquite, the teller tried to be tricky by hiding a dye pack in the stacks of cash. But Cowboy Bob wasn't duped and actually handed the stack with the dye pack back to the teller before leaving with the rest of the cash.
No way.
Exactly.
So, wow.
So he was
able. Where did he learn all this?
Don't know.
I wonder if he's got like a friend that went to prison for bank robbery and he's been, or maybe there's a book about bank robbery. I don't know. But wow.
How to bank robbery. Mm-hmm.
So he was feeling the stacks as they came and he felt a rigid one and he was like, mm-mm.
That's what it seems like. Or somehow maybe he was flipping through them or maybe he saw her, you know, like she went and went like that and, you know,
nervously grabbed
something else from what you hear. And he was like, she grabbed it, you know, a decoy stack with a dye pack in it. Something tipped him off to where he was like,
fascinating.
Isn't that really interesting?
Who is this guy?
Well, by this time, the FBI was quite annoyed with Cowboy Bob, and they were no closer to catching him than they had been the first time he struck. Steve Powell from the FBI told Texas Monthly that Cowboy Bob was, quote, making me start to pull my hair out. How could this thin little dried up cowboy be whipping us this bad time after time? In September, Cowboy Bob robbed for the fifth time, hitting First Gibraltar Bank in Mesquite for $1,722. Just like in the second robbery, a witness got the license plate number off the Grand Prix, which was traced to a local resident whose plates had been stolen.
And it was a brown Grand Prix again.
Yes, it's the same car, different plates. The FBI started their investigation when they got a call about another bank robbery that had just occurred about a mile away.
Whoa, two in one day?
Yep.
What bank is this?
This is the First Interstate Bank, again in Mesquite.
These are all tiny little banks.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And this time, Cowboy Bob had ran off with a whopping $13,706.
Holy moly. He hit the jackpot.
The teller said he was so thrilled with the amount that he got that he even tipped his hat to her before leaving.
No.
Yep. And once again, someone wrote down the license plate of the Grand Prix he was seen leaving in. So the FBI, again, had to go track down this lead, probably super annoyed that they had to do the whole dog and pony show once more. Because remember, they had just done that this morning.
Mm-hmm.
They had just tracked him down this morning using those license plates, didn't lead to anything. I mean, and this had happened a couple times now. And this was a different license plate than he had used in the previous robbery. So it's all very weird. Well, this time, the license plate led them to a man named Pete Tallis, who worked in Carrollton, a northeast suburb of Dallas. Uh-huh. So the FBI go talk to this Pete Tallis, and he confirmed that he did indeed own a brown Grand Prix with a license plate that matched the one spotted in the most recent bank robbery. But he said he no longer was in possession of the car as he had given it to his mother and sister a year earlier. He explained that his mother and sister lived together and couldn't afford a car, which is why he had given him his old one. He also provided the FBI agents with the address of their apartment in Garland. So now the FBI have to go track down this address in Garland.
Boy, you're not kidding. This is all around Dallas.
It's really weird. So they go to the address and they see the now infamous Brown Grand Prix in the parking lot. This was officially the closest they had been to an actual break in the case. So they took a few minutes out in the parking lot to talk over what their next steps were going to be.
Stakeout.
Well, while discussing their plan, they saw a woman in her mid to late 40s walk out from the apartment building, hop into the car, and drive away. And so now they have kind of a bit of an issue. So they're like, what do we do? This is probably Cowboy Bob's girlfriend or family member, friend, whatever, and he's not with her. So should we move forward with going up to the apartment and seeing if he's there in the apartment, or should we track her down and see if she'll talk?
I would just follow the car.
Well, that's exactly what they did. They follow the Grand Prix, and they pulled it over just after they knew that they were out of eyeshot of the apartments, in case Cowboy Bob's out there looking out the window, so he doesn't know that she's been pulled over. So the woman in the car introduced herself as Peggy Jo Tallis. So this would be Pete Tallis's sister, the one who said that he gave the car to his sister. Makes sense. She admitted that the car was hers, and when asked what she'd been up to that day, she said she'd gone to a plant nursery to buy fertilizer. And indeed, there was a bag of fertilizer in the trunk of the car.
Okay.
Everything checks out so far. Weird, but nothing that really, you know...
There wasn't just a bag of money in the backseat.
Exactly. Nothing that out of the ordinary.
Or the cowboy hat sitting there on the dash.
Seems very normal. So they asked Peggy Jo if they could search her apartment, and she agrees to it. Peggy Jo's mother, Helen, answered the door to their apartment and was obviously terrified when she opens the door and a bunch of FBI agents basically surge past her into the apartment, guns drawn, looking for Cowboy Bob. So she, you know, she's freaked out and Peggy Jo's like, I don't know what's going on. And so everybody's very confused. They search the apartment. Cowboy Bob isn't there. No one else is in the apartment besides Helen. But there were hints of Cowboy Bob. There was a styrofoam mannequin head with a beard attached to it.
I knew it.
A cowboy hat and a bag full of money hidden under Peggy Jo's bed.
So it was a fake beard.
Mm-hmm. It was a fake beard. Now, all of these things are found within the apartment. So they know that Peggy Jo and or Helen are involved in these robberies. So Agent Powell told Peggy Jo he knew she was hiding a man from them.
Powell's on the prowl.
She answered, there isn't any man. I promise you that. And as if seeing her for the first time, he noticed a bit of gray dye in her hair.
No.
And a few bits of spirit glue still stuck to her face.
No, it's her.
She was telling the truth. There was no man, because Peggy Jo Tallis was indeed the elusive bank robber, Cowboy Bob.
No. Yep. Did she have a paunch?
She did not have a paunch.
So was it? Oh, I'm this guessing this is some other.
This a very elaborate disguise.
Wow.
That she created.
Yep. That's amazing.
It is amazing.
I love it.
So,
what a great disguise.
Yes.
Just make yourself look like the most ridiculous, like, ranch worker. Yep. Yeah.
That's right.
Man.
And again, and doing it in a way that it's not, you're in Texas. You're in an area where men dress like this a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So, it's not something that's going to be crazy. It's not going to obviously look like a disguise.
And the more layers that you put on, the more the jacket, all that stuff helps cover up that you're a woman. Man, and then the fact that she didn't say anything, she never spoke. Okay, interesting.
That's right.
Fascinated by this. What a great plan.
Yay, I'm glad it was a surprise because I've been so nervous the whole time I was going to somehow give it up. Okay, so who the hell was Peggy Jo Tallis?
She have some acting experience?
Nope.
I mean,
ooh, she sure did not.
I feel like she's some like pocket theater like expert or something, you know?
No, I mean, she had a pretty normal life. She was born in the mid-1940s, and she grew up in Grand Prairie, west of Dallas. So you've heard us talk about Dallas, obviously. You've heard us talk about Arlington several times, especially in the Lisa Renee case.
Uh-huh.
Well, Grand Prairie is smack dab between Arlington and Dallas.
Yep, I used to play disc golf there quite a bit when
I used to work there.
Yeah, you did.
So this is where she grew up. She lived with her older brother and sister and her mother, Helen. Her father died of cancer when she was very young. She was a pretty, spunky, independent girl, a bit of a wild child growing up. She liked poetry and drag races and rock and roll music, and she was very much a free spirit. Her favorite movie, according to the Texas Monthly article, was 1969's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which seemed a little telling because...
That's on the nose.
It's a movie set in the Old West about a gang of robbers who hit up banks and trains. It's very interesting, and apparently she used to watch this movie quite often.
And I've thought about doing Butch Cassidy for the show because he's robbed banks in Texas.
Oh.
And we could get into that in a future episode.
Well, there you go. There's a little teaser for a future Shay episode. She had a string of jobs in her adulthood. She was a receptionist at a hotel, a worker at a computer factory. She worked in an office at a construction company. She worked as a package deliverer. A little bit of this and that. She didn't really have an established career or anything. Her friends said that she wasn't terribly interested in establishing a career or making a ton of money or having a family or any of these types of things. She really just wanted enough to get by. And
just to be comfortable.
Exactly. She told her friends that she wanted to earn enough to one day move to Mexico and spend her days living in a hacienda on the beach.
Man, that sounds pretty good.
It sounds pretty nice.
We've been to Mexico. That's a pretty good way to end your retirement.
Right. I would be happy with that, too.
Hey, these margaritas are making me feel like I'm on the beach already.
You need to stop drinking those margaritas.
Never.
Her friend said that she was wild at heart. So this is very much like free spirit, independent, kind of go your own way type of woman. It didn't really seem like she was ever super invested in dating or relationships either, but there was one relationship that seemed to have really affected her, and not in a good way. She had been dating a man seriously for a while, and one day she saw his car parked somewhere with a woman in it. She asked the woman, who are you? What are you doing? And the woman responded that she was waiting for her husband in their car.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And this just broke her heart because she was really in love with this guy, and she had no idea that he was married. And after this, one of her friends told Texas Monthly that it seemed like this kind of soured her on men and relationships in general. She just seemed to resign herself or to prefer herself being alone.
Okay, that's fine. Some people do that.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing wrong with that. And, that's really what I get from Peggy Jo Tallis. She really sounded like someone who was friendly and carefree, but someone who was also very independent, very private. And she did what she wanted and didn't really need anyone or anything else. Well, in the mid-1980s, her mom, Helen, became very ill with some kind of degenerative bone disease.
Oh.
Now, I'm not sure exactly what she was suffering from, if it was osteoporosis or severe osteoarthritis or something different. Yeah. But basically, her mother became bedridden or close to it and in a lot of pain.
How'd she answer the door that day, then?
She literally,
pulled herself out of bed.
Yeah.
That's even worse.
Yeah, I know.
Why didn't she just let the FBI in?
I don't know.
Oh, make your poor mother get out of bed?
I know. Oh,
that's terrible.
Well, to them, they thought there was a bank robber in the house. So they're not just going to be like, hey, Peggy Jo, why don't you come and open up the door so we can blast this guy? You know what I mean?
Maybe she offered and told them, but they're like, no, we're going to go knock on the door.
That's probably what it was. So Peggy Jo moved her mother in with her and essentially became her full-time caretaker. Over the next few years, the cost of Helen's treatments and medication and all of that began to really pile up. And unfortunately, things became even worse when Peggy Jo herself started developing her own medical issues.
Oh, no.
So she ended up injuring her back, and she even had to undergo an emergency mastectomy. And so all of this meant she herself became bedridden, at least for a time, and in pain, and had her own medications and her own health to deal with, had to miss work and all of that, while still taking care of her ailing mother.
Man, now you're making me feel bad for Cowboy Bob.
I think it's a really tragic case, honestly. Her mom did receive Social Security, but even between that and Peggy Jo's income, there was just bills piling up. It points to something that is an issue, which is we know now that caregivers undergo a lot of physical and psychological stress when caring for a family member. According to the article, Physical and Mental Effects of Family Caregiving, which was published in the American Journal of Nursing in 2008, quote, caregiving has all the features of a chronic stress experience. It creates physical and psychological strain over extended periods of time, is accompanied by high levels of unpredictability and uncontrollability, has the capacity to create secondary stress in multiple life domains, such as work and family relationships, and frequently requires high levels of vigilance. Caregiving fits the formula for chronic stress so well that it is used as a model for studying the health effects of chronic stress. So was her caretaking of her ailing mother an excuse for what Peggy Jo did? No, but I think it might be a mitigating factor, or at least something that may help explain why Peggy Jo, someone who seemed to be a good law-abiding citizen, to suddenly go on the string of bank robberies.
Successful bank robberies, too, man. Yeah. Man, she knew a lot about robbing a bank.
She really did. And because we can sit here and say, well, she needed the money for bills and medication, and that's why she decided to start robbing. But maybe there was something else here, this underlying psychological stress, depression, whatever else that then affected her decision making. And again, this is something that we know a lot about now, about caregivers and how caregivers or family members, they go through so much stress and their mental health really needs to be checked upon. Do you think that they thought about that back in the 80s and the early 90s? No. There's definitely not something. I mean, mental health was not even something people really talked about back then anyway, but especially just because you were a caregiver.
Sure.
Nobody was thinking about those things or checking up on Peggy Jo, making sure she was okay. Now, obviously, you know, we talked about Peggy's brother, and she also had a sister, and I'm sure other family members, and I'm sure helped Helen and taking care of Helen, and maybe probably helped with, you know, financially here and there. But ultimately, Helen lived with Peggy. And so Peggy was always going to be the primary caregiver. And again, you know, sometimes when you're a caregiver, you need to be on top of your own mental health and making sure that, you know, you're also taking care of yourself. Maybe that's not something that was happening with Peggy Jo.
Yeah. Practice some self-wellness, you know, and like take some mental health breaks, go do something for yourself.
I mean, talk to somebody.
Yeah. Get a counselor, you know, I mean, oh man, so many people could do with a bit of counseling, a bit of maybe some medication from time to time.
Now she did actually, during this period, she did get on anti-anxiety medication. I know that for sure. But
it just made her more cool and collected during the bank robberies. Is that?
Well, I think it's a thing of like, okay, she was on anti-anxiety medication, but what about? I mean, was anybody talking to her? Was she in therapy? What about her depression or potential depression? You know, this is all just part of the story. Mm-hmm. Something interesting to maybe help us think about what was going on in Peggy Jo's mind. One of her closest friends told Texas Monthly, "quote She was too proud to ask anyone for help. She liked helping people. She didn't want people to help her. This is hard to explain, but I think Peg was starting to feel, well, like her life was slipping away. Do you know what I mean? You get to a place in your life and you start looking back and you say to yourself that it's not working out the way you hoped. You think everything is slipping away and you feel, I don't know, crazy. You want to scream or something. I think Peg missed being wild at heart." And we can assume that it was around this time and at the age of 46, that Peggy Jo decided to pull a Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and start robbing banks. She purchased men's clothing and boots, a fake beard and gray hair paint from a local costume supply store. And one morning she donned her disguise, stuffed towels under her clothes to appear heavier than she was, and most likely to also disguise her hips and her chest. And she left to rob her very first bank. So after her arrest in the fall of 1992, the media went crazy. This was big news at the time, obviously. Her family and friends were stunned. No one knew that Peggy Jo was doing this, and no one would even thought she was capable of it.
I'm stunned.
So obviously, everyone wanted Peggy Jo to talk. Everyone wanted to hear her story about why a middle-aged woman who never really had problems with the law would suddenly start robbing banks all by herself. Bank robbery is a very male-dominated crime, even today. In the Texas Monthly article, Skip estimated that women were responsible for less than 5% of bank robberies, so that was back in 2005. Although the total number of women involved in bank robbery has risen by a few percentage points, it's still pretty true today. So I looked at FBI statistics, and the latest from 2016 shows that women were involved in about 7% of all bank robberies.
Still very small.
Yeah, so the figures slightly increased, but certainly not by much. In a way, she's interesting just in this sort of academic or psychological perspective of crime because she's so atypical. How did she learn what to do? The calmness, the note, the disguise, the swapping out of license plates.
Yes.
Why did she rob two banks that last day? And why did she swap out the plates on her car the second time around with the plates that actually belonged to the car when she went to rob that second
bank? That's a big mistake.
Yeah. So we have all of these questions that everyone wants the answers to. But Peggy Jo wouldn't talk. She wouldn't talk to Steve Powell of the FBI, not to her own lawyer, not really even to the psychologist her lawyer hired to interview her. The only thing she ever really said about her string of robberies was that she decided to rob that first bank to help pay for her mother's medication, and she hadn't intended to continue. What I think is she kind of saw how easy it was after that first time, and so each time after that, it became just easier and easier. Not only the job itself, but mentally, I think it became easier for her to decide, well, I'm just going to do one more.
And it's empowering, too. You know, like, she has all the focus, all the power, you know, this is...
empowering, it's freeing.
Yeah.
It's, you know, her own little, like, personal secret.
And like you said, she had a fascination with Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid.
Mm-hmm. Well, her friend said to Texas Monthly, I guess it was just hard for her to admit just how fun she had being a bank robber.
Yeah, exactly. And
that's probably a part of it as well. Well, she ended up receiving just 33 months in a federal prison for her crimes, which is not a lot, I think, for six bank robberies, especially considering bank robbery usually comes with relatively stiff sentences since they are federal crimes. But the penalties are assessed based on how much was stolen. So that's kind of the base sentence. And then whether or not a deadly weapon was used, whether or not anyone was injured, and whether or not anyone was killed. And then these charges are tacked on to that base sentence.
I see. She never brandished a weapon.
No.
I didn't even think about that. They were just assuming the whole time that she had a weapon.
Well, I mean, not even necessarily. Bank employees are basically told, hey, if somebody asks for you for money, just give it to them.
Yeah, but so you don't know.
You like, don't know. Yeah. But she'd never brandished a weapon. And for as far as anyone is aware, she never had one on her. I'm not even sure if she owned a weapon at this point. So, yeah, exactly.
That's even more ballsy, though.
Yeah.
To go in there without a gun. I mean, what if a security guard tried to pull a gun on you or something?
But that's the thing. It's not really necessarily even ballsy. It's just smart. Because had she had a weapon on her, if she didn't intend to use it, you're going to get charged for then that intent to harm or the, you know, it's going to be an armed
threat with the deadly
robbery
weapon
versus just a robbery, which is that's going to up the charges tremendously. And so that's one of the reasons why she didn't get a very large sentence, which is really smart if you think about
it. This is a fascinating case.
And ultimately, that base sentence that I was talking about, well, Peggy Jo didn't even really end up taking a lot of cash each robbery. It was a few thousand on average, besides that last robbery, which netted her $13,000, but it wasn't a lot in total. On top of that, she didn't have a huge rap sheet. This was something seemingly out of character for her. She was a woman, and I think you could make the argument that in a case like this, that might have helped her. And most importantly, like you said, she was never armed. She never threatened anyone with a weapon. No one ever got hurt. So at the end of the day, for whatever reason, she served just under 3 years for her crimes.
Yeah. It was just very successfully pulled off from her point of view.
And that's the thing. Everybody wanted to hear this story. And while she was in prison, she was approached with book deals, movie deals, and she could have potentially made a lot of money off of all of this.
I'm sure.
But she shot them all down. She apparently didn't want the publicity. She didn't want to put her family through all of that. And again, it really did seem that Peggy Jo Tallis was a private person. And I think the thought of telling her life story to the world was just something that was wholly unappealing to her. And I think to some degree, I think she might have kind of been embarrassed maybe over her actions. You know, this was her little secret life that she led completely under the radar. And to let people into that, I think was just upsetting to her.
And not telling the truth actually upholds the mythology of it.
Yeah, to some degree, it definitely does. Well, Peggy Jo served her time. She got out of prison and she moved her and her mother to a little house in Garland. And life pretty much went back to normal. She again became her mother's full-time caretaker. Her mother, Helen, at this time had gotten even worse, and so she needed even more care. So Peggy Jo had to feed her, bathe her, give her medication, all of that. She found work at the Harbor Bay Marina at Lake Ray Hubbard, just east of Dallas. This is one of the biggest lakes in Texas. It has fishing, boating, water skiing, plus a bunch of hiking trails and other outdoor activities in the area. So it sounds really nice. I've never been there personally, but it sounds like a nice place to be. Well, she worked at the marina store, just a little convenience store, basically, where they sold snacks and drinks and bait, boating supplies, basically all the convenient stuff you'd need on your trip to the lake.
They let her oversee a cash register, huh?
That's right. And her fellow employees were interviewed by Skip Hollandsworth, and they said she was an incredible worker. The till was never short on her shifts. You know, she was honest, hardworking. She really seemed happy and in her element there. And in fact, she really got to know the people who came in. She'd help customers who were short on cash, especially if they didn't seem like they had a lot of money and they needed something. She would be like, oh, hey, I'll spot you the $5 or whatever. She even one time gave away some of her money to a man who had just gotten out of prison and he was down on his luck. So she gave money to that guy. I mean, this was a woman who really seemingly liked helping people. Again, according to her coworkers, was happy for a while. Because in December of 2002, something changed. Oh, and that's that Helen passed away. Naturally, Peggy Jo was glad that her mother was no longer in pain, but she was also heartbroken because she was probably a little lost without her mom. Helen had been this constant in her life. She had done so much to make sure that Helen was taken care of and she had her medications. At this point, it was like, well, what do I do now? Where do I go with my life now that I don't have this person to take care of?
Yeah, it's a big change.
Yeah. Well, a couple years later, it looked like she made her decision on what she was going to do. She sold or gave away pretty much all of her possessions, including her car, and she paid $6,000 for an RV. And she went off to live that wild and free dream she'd always had.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, she stayed in touch with some close people in her life, but for spans of time, no one really knew where she went. She just kind of drove around Texas in her RV and seemed to become that free spirit she'd always really wanted to be. Or did she? Because in October of 2004, a man in a big floppy hat and gloves entered the Guarantee Bank in Tyler, Texas. The man set a bag on the counter and told the teller, quote, all your money, no bait bills, no blow-up money. He made off with an undisclosed amount of cash, and no one saw what vehicle he drove off in. But the teller said this man appeared to have a mustache that it was glued on, and his voice was very soft, almost feminine. Was this Peggy Jo, or was it someone else, perhaps someone who got inspired by the tale of Cowboy Bob? Well, we might never know. But what we do know is that the following year, that same Guarantee Bank in Tyler was robbed again. And this time it was robbed by Peggy Jo Tallis, now 60 years old.
No.
Yep. Peggy Jo donned a black top and pants, a big black hat, and large black sunglasses. She parked her RV at the Jack in the Box across the street from the Guarantee Bank and walked into the bank. She told the teller, this is a robbery. I need all of your money. Don't set any alarms. So the teller did what she was asked, handing over a sum of $11,241. Certainly enough to fund Peggy Jo's simple life for a while, or maybe even for her to go live on a beach somewhere like she had always dreamed.
Yeah.
But for the first time, Peggy Jo didn't check for a dye pack. And after she walked out of the bank, one exploded in the bag carrying the money, staining and ruining everything she'd just taken. She hurried across the street to her RV, red smoke streaming from the bag. Eyewitnesses in the busy area saw all of this, and a local couple named Courtney and Chris Smith immediately called the police and started following the RV the robber jumped into. Turns out, the robbery the year before at that same Guarantee Bank wasn't the only bank robbery in Tyler in recent history. The city had actually been struck multiple times, enough to have a group of FBI agents and police officers on the streets at the ready, literally just lying in wait for another bank robbery to happen.
Was Powell on the prowl again?
This is not Powell. I think by this time he was already retired.
Okay.
So within minutes, authorities arrived on the scene, and since Chris and Courtney Smith were on the phone with dispatch and following the RV, they were able to locate the RV pretty much immediately, especially considering a huge lumbering RV is probably not the best choice for a getaway vehicle.
That's what I was going to say. Such a weird choice.
A bad choice, I would say, for sure. So police surrounded the RV, cutting it off from escape. And at this point, they only knew that there was a suspect reported as possibly a white female who had just robbed the Guarantee Bank. They don't know if this description is even correct or if this was the work of only one person, or if the person or people in the RV are armed. So there's a bit of a standoff with the police with their weapons drawn and aimed at the RV, calling out for the suspects to give up and come out, and complete silence and no movement coming from the RV. Finally, after several minutes of waiting, the door to the RV opened. "You're going to have to kill me," Peggy Jo said. "You don't have to do this," the officers replied. "You mean to tell me if I come out of here with a gun and point it at y'all, you're not going to shoot me?" she asked them. "Please don't. Please don't do that," the officers begged. And Peggy Jo stepped out of the RV, brandishing a gun in her hand. She pointed it at the officers, and in an instant, four officers fired, their bullets converging on Peggy Jo Tallis, killing her.
Man.
As Skip Hollinsworth points out in the article, the officers who shot and killed Peggy Jo Tallis were naturally very upset by the hand they were dealt in having to shoot a little old lady who was pretty much the age of their mothers or even their grandmothers.
That's a horrible thing to have to do.
Yeah. At least one of them sought counseling for the guilt that remained after her death. And this is something that we talked about as well in the Dimebag Daryl episode. Even if you have no choice, even if your actions were in defense of yourself and others, if you shoot and kill someone, a lot of the times that's going to mess you up.
Yeah.
And I think that's a pretty natural reaction. Even if, you know, you did the right thing, it's still hard. But what's harder is that when they secured the scene and went to where Peggy Jo lay, they discovered that the gun she had brandished at them was fake.
Oh, no.
It was a toy. What's even more grim is that inside the RV, they recovered a .357 Magnum. So for some reason, in those moments inside the vehicle, when she was apparently making her mind up as to what to do next, she chose the fake gun instead of the real one. Why? It's so bizarre. The only thing I can think of is she wanted to do a suicide by cop, and maybe she wanted to ensure that there was no way she could fire back and hurt someone accidentally or something.
Yeah,
as maybe. in her mind, she was protecting them. But it's so messed up because that means that those police officers now have to live with the fact that not only did they shoot and kill this, you know, little old lady, but that she wasn't even actually a threat.
Yeah, there's like a threat that of poetic irony in her actions there.
Kind of.
Yeah.
But was it an F you to them, or was it I just don't want to hurt you? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of my question. Yep. Now, of course, there was no way for them to have known that in the moment she was holding a toy gun.
No.
It apparently looked very much like a real gun. She came out. She told them, "I want you to kill them," essentially. She brandished a gun at them, or what appeared to be a gun. There are pedestrians and onlookers around watching this whole thing unfold. I mean, this was just on the street in the middle of Tyler, Texas.
Yeah, and she also clarified, "What are you going to do if I come out with a gun?
You're going to have to shoot me, guys." Exactly. I mean, she was really asking for it. I mean, essentially, that's exactly what she did. And I think she really made her mind up. I'm not going to leave this alive. I don't want to go back to jail or, you know, whatever was going on in her mind. Even after all that, the knowledge that the gun wasn't real after the fact must just be gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
So just that's the thing I want to know more than anything else is why did she take a toy gun when there was a real gun right there? It's
and
just
again,
so bizarre.
It all goes to her mystery and her mythology.
Yeah. Well, that absolutely.
She
and that's
never
the thing.
Spoke. We still don't know all these questions.
So not knowing if there were additional suspects in the RV besides this little old lady, a SWAT team threw tear gas in the RV and pushed inside. They found no one else, obviously, just a perfectly made bed, a small amount of marijuana, and $38 in cash, and of course, the .357 Magnum. Even today, there are still a lot of questions about Peggy Jo Tallis. She's definitely an enigma. And because she was so fiercely private and didn't talk to anyone about her crimes, not even friends and family, we'll never really know why she made the decisions that she made. We just kind of have to guess. And as far as her crimes go, were the Cowboy Bob robberies her first? And was this last robbery where she got caught, was this the only one she attempted after her release from prison? How successful was she, really, as a criminal and a bank robber? We'll never know, and it's something that is so fascinating about her.
Yeah.
It's almost like, intentionally or not, she made herself into one of those bank robbing legends, like in her favorite movie. She made herself into this historical or even legendary character. And speaking of which, last year it was announced that a film is going to be made about Peggy Jo Tallis and Cowboy Bob.
Really?
That's right. It's still in the very early stages of production, but it's slated to be directed by Michael Showalter and produced by Jake Gyllenhaal's production company. And at least at the moment, it's going to be called The Last Ride of Cowboy Bob, which is the name of Skip Hollandsworth's article. So it's either going to be a nod to him, or maybe Skip will actually be involved on some level in the movie as a consultant or a writer or something. Either way, I think this could be a fascinating movie. I am really here for it. I would love to see somebody else's vision of who she was and what was going through her mind.
Yeah.
Because she's just such an incredibly interesting and I think tragic character. I feel like she, at the heart of it, she was just a very sad and lonely woman. And I don't know. I feel sad for her. But at the same time, man, she put up a fight.
She went out on her own terms. She was extremely intelligent, very capable, and just a fascinating mythological criminal.
Yeah, very much a legend, man.
Man, it's weird. It's a weird case. I feel off kilter.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a weird story.
Yeah, the true crime fan in me wants to not like her, but the human
but,
in me
yeah, no, you can't,
and the
you
fascination
can't.
Makes me want to like her.
I know, and that's the thing. That it's just such a bummer. I really wish that there were interviews with her.
Answers.
Or something where she talked at least a little bit about herself and explained some of these questions, because, I mean, as it is, I have no idea.
It doesn't sound like there's anyone alive who has those answers.
I don't think so.
Even her friends had a different perspective of her real nature, which she kept very close to the vest. What a good story. What a good episode.
Yeah.
I loved this case.
Well, you can definitely thank Skip Hollandsworth. Yeah, it's just such an incredible, incredible story. I am so excited for this movie. I hope it comes out soon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I want to go to the first screening and meet Skip Hollandsworth and, like, watch it. Like, that'd be cool.
That'd be cool to watch it with Skip Hollandsworth and be like, hey, Skip, what's up?
Yeah, maybe, like, at the Alamo Drafthouse in Austin, the original.
Hey, Skip, if you're out there.
Yeah.
Hit us up.
Yeah, we can promo it.
Like, Skip needs our help for promotion. Well, there you go. That is the story of Peggy Jo Tallis and Cowboy Bob.
Man, what a good episode.
Yeah. Thank you. Wow. I'm glad you liked it. It's definitely, man, I just feel very flummoxed about the whole thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of twists and turns, man, but I think that's what makes a really good true crime story, though. Well, do you think we're ready to move on to something else in the nature of news that is good?
I think so. Let's do it.
We'll be right back after this. All right, guys, welcome back. And this is the segment of the show where we're going to talk about some good news, give you a little palate cleanser, tell you something good that's going on from our local Texas news affiliates from around the state. What I got for you, Aaron, is an awesome story about young kid cancer survivors. So, we all know about cancer, right? It's a awful, terrible, debilitating disease that you have to go through this horrible treatment phase and you end up stuck in a hospital for months and months. And a lot of times with kids, they're separated from their families, they get some visitation, they have some opportunities to have some involvement, but I imagine it's very lonely. And it's very prone to having an onset of depression and anxiety. You know, you're just stuck in this hospital for a long time. Well, there's an organization that's called Sunshine Kids. This was actually started by Rhonda Tomasco back in 1982. And she was serving as a volunteer for a pediatric cancer unit at the hospital in Houston, Texas. And after seeing the loneliness and the depression for a lot of the children in this unit, she decided to make a difference. And she got this vision for this program to put cancer patients, specifically young ones, into a program where they would get opportunities to participate into positive reinforcement groups. This culminates into this plan to have several events throughout the year where all these young cancer patients can get together, they can commune, they can talk about their disease, they can talk about how they're all championing through cancer and beating it, and they can do something in a recreational environment. This program, the Sunshine Kids Foundation, has actually spread throughout the nation, and it's a very successful foundation. It's awesome. If you want to donate to them and you want to promote the Sunshine Kids, I'll put the links in the episode description and we'll get that information out for you. They're an awesome group to be involved with. It basically gives these kids availability to activities that are completely free of charge for them and their families to go and be a part of during this horrible, horrible disease that they're trying to defeat. So some of the activities that they do are much like the one that I'm going to talk to you about in this article from the Austin Statesman. They just recently had a big meetup on Lake Travis for this organization. All the kids got together. They got a bunch of volunteers from the Austin Police Department to come down, and they took them out on Lake Travis, and they used Sea-Doos, they had a boat party, they had activities on the beach. They took them all over the place on Lake Travis. They had a really good time. There's links and pictures that I'll forward. So it involved kids from across the state of Texas, as well as Louisiana, to attend the 8th annual Teen Lake Escape. The kids had a great time. They got to do law enforcement demonstrations, and they got to get interested in different career paths in law enforcement. If you're interested, go donate. Check it out. It's really cool. We've all had a family member that suffered from cancer at one time or another. I'm sure you can reach out and think of somebody.
Yeah, it sounds fun. And definitely, like you were saying, I'm sure that it's helpful to have those kind of organizations that are specifically for people who are suffering under these really hard times and everything, and they get together and kind of forget about the struggles they're going through for a while, but also be around other people who are struggling in the same way.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that's very comforting, and fighting disease can be very lonely and very isolating. And so this seems like something that can really help move people past that. So it sounds like a really great organization.
That's right.
Also, this lake party sounds like a lot of fun, and I wish I went.
That's right. You hit the nail on the head. Well, now is the perfect time to introduce our next segment, which happens to be our promo for the week, Aaron.
That's right. So remember, guys, we do our 5-star reviews now after our promo, so we can really highlight those recommendations that we have for other podcasts. And we have a doozy for you this week, you guys. This is a fantastic podcast called Getting Off.
It basically is founded by two defense attorneys who want to give you the inside scoop on a lot of cases you've always wanted more information on. They have profiles of the trial, they do a focus on defense strategies, and they really go into pop culture and the media and how they fixate on the particular crime itself. I love this podcast. Like, you know how we got really into Making a Murderer and The Staircase and cases like that? I just have been binging the last 4 episodes, and man, they're fascinating. They're everything that I ever wanted from a case that involves two defense lawyers telling me how people got off of those cases.
Or how people got convicted in other cases, yeah, as well. Because they also talk about the prosecution strategies and everything. Definitely. Like that. And what's really cool is, all of us who are not in the legal field, we all have assumptions about how the law works. And quite frankly, a lot of those are incorrect. Mm-hmm. And what's really cool about this podcast is you learn so much. Listen to like a case study that they've done and you walk away and you're like, oh, I'm now a genius because I've learned so much. I can then use that knowledge to transfer on this next case that I'm going to be researching or looking into myself or whatever. Plus, on top of that, they're really funny. They have a really good charisma, really good banter back and forth.
They're really good people. They're personable.
And just to give you some idea about some of the cases they've covered, they covered Michelle Carter. They've covered Warren Jeffs, the Menendez brothers. Episodes that they did were really good. They've done Casey Anthony, Jodi Arias. I also listened to some of their earlier episodes on Harvey Milk. Like, they have done so many cases that you're like, I know everything about that case already. Well, no, you didn't, because you haven't heard like 2 criminal defense attorneys telling you all of the finer details and everything going on in the back end. So definitely, like, this is, we've said this before, like, oh, you have to check this out. You have to listen to this podcast if you're interested in true crime. I think it's really important that we kind of get this knowledge base, because we're all wrong about the things that we think. if you're not a lawyer. And this is going to really break down those.
If you've ever asked questions like, how did this happen? How did this work? What was the decision that the defense lawyers made to do this strategy? They're going to let you know in these particular cases.
Yeah, it's really good stuff. So we're going to play that promo right now, and be sure to listen to that and come back afterwards for our 5-star reviews. Getting off, getting off.
Are you a true crime junkie that's looking for a different perspective?
Have you ever read about a famous case and wondered how it was possible that a defendant got acquitted?
Are you interested in criminal justice reform?
Do you often find yourself making extraordinarily inappropriate jokes while swearing like a sailor?
Then the Getting Off podcast is for you.
Hosted by us.
Two real live criminal defense attorneys.
Getting Off explains the legal reasons behind outcomes in famous trials and tackles tough topics in the world of crime and criminal justice.
We use firsthand sources like trial transcripts, police reports, crime scene photographs, and appeals briefs to give you the information that the public rarely hears about when it comes to the criminal justice system.
Our podcast isn't about carefully crafted musical interludes or obsessively edited narratives.
Instead, it is a no-holds-barred, unedited, raw legal presentation by two lawyers that have spent over a decade each in the trenches.
Previously covered cases include Casey Anthony, Michael Peterson, Jody Arias, and more.
Subscribe to the Getting Off podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Do that to get off now.
All right, guys, this is the part of the show where we read our 5-star reviews on Facebook and iTunes. We do this as a thank you for everybody who loves the show and gives us 5-star reviews. We've gotten some good ones lately. And remember, you can also find us on social media. We are on Twitter at ACNC Podcast, and we are on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. And if you'd like to shoot us a line, question, comment, dumb remark, case suggestion, blah, 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 shoot us an email at
allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. Damn it.
I don't know why
you tried to do it together for some reason. Go ahead.
Okay.
Our first Facebook review comes from Kathy Warren, who's a big fan of the show. She says, I came across this podcast through another Facebook group. I'm absolutely hooked. I love the chemistry between Shay and Aaron. Wonderful podcast, entertaining, and fun to listen to. Thanks, Kathy, for your review. We really appreciate it. And thanks for all of your extended work on the Facebook page. You brought up an interesting quiz for everybody, and we turned it into a sticker contest. That was really awesome. And thanks for listening. We appreciate your support.
Yeah, thank you, Kathy. The next one comes from Lena Lundquist. At least that's how I'm going to pronounce your last name. Not sure if that's right. But they said, love all of it, with multiple exclamation points. Well, thank you, Nina. We love you, too. Deborah Henning says, this has quickly become one of my go-to podcasts. As a former employee at Missing Kids, I love the cases Shay and Aaron select, and that they don't overlook cases involving victims from minorities, because those are oftentimes cases that don't get much attention. The opening theme is perfect, and I look forward to every new episode. P.S. I'd love to see a photo of the host sometime. It's always nice to put a face to the voices. No. All right, Deborah, let me paint you a picture. Shay looks like a slightly shorter Dirk Nowitzki.
That's what people
Did
say.
Did I pronounce his name right? Dirk. Dirk Nowitzki. In fact, that's Shay's new nickname. Detective Shea Butter's out. Dirk Nowitzki's in.
Nope. Never going to air.
And I look like Dimebag Darrell.
No.
I already said that a few episodes ago.
Have a big pink goatee.
So there you go, Deborah. Thank you for review. And I hope that answers some questions for you. Bridget Knox says, Aaron and Shay sound like my kind of people. I love your chemistry and banter. I love that you share your references from research and the detailed accounts you give. The sound quality is also great. Come to Seattle. Let's get some beers and pizza. Bridget, we're on our way.
That sounds good.
After this, we're going to order our plane tickets. And I'm assuming, since you offered, you're going to put us up. Cool. We'll see you soon, Bridget.
We're going to need a king-size bed.
And all the beer and pizza, not just some. All of it in Seattle. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Bridget. We'll see you soon.
We're large folk. That's why we need such a big bed.
Hey.
No, I'm just saying we're tall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not girth.
Well, maybe a little of that, too. All right. Do you want to do this as the last one?
Sure.
Tracy Watson says, love this podcast. Y'all are great. Thank you, Tracy.
You know what? You're great. I'm glad you recognize that.
Me too, Tracy.
Tracy.
You're a good person.
Watson, let me tell you, you're a great A human being.
That's right.
Ready to move on to iTunes 5-star reviews?
Yeah, sure.
Let me scoop my fat butt up here. All right. Karen Lett says, love, 5 stars. My husband and I really enjoy binging on your podcast episodes. Looking forward to more. On a side note, back in the early 70s, my dad was shot in the head and his best friend was murdered during a robbery in Cleburne. I don't know / remember much of the story, and my dad has been dead for many years. However, I do remember him telling me once that the men were related and that their family was killed in a wreck, headed to visit them in prison. I have always been interested in finding out if that was true and the other facts of the robbery. You've encouraged me to give digging into this case another attempt.
Wow, that's definitely heavy. But I really hope that you find some information, find some details about all of that. Hopefully you can do some searching and be able to find something that might kind of answer some of those questions that you have for sure.
But thank you for your review. We appreciate it.
Yeah, and good luck with everything.
Mandy019 says, fantastic work, you two. 5 stars. Really enjoying the episodes. Well-researched and delivered superbly. Thanks.
Thank you. You know what else is superb? You.
Yeah, you're superb. You're awesome. And you know what? Everybody who listens and supports this podcast, we just blew past 200,000 downloads, and you're all superb, and we love each and every one of you. Thank you. What?
Nothing. That was very powerful, very almost angry, I would say.
No, I'm so excited.
Thank you!
I'm so excited for all of our listeners, and I appreciate their support of the show.
Cool. Is that the last one?
No.
Oh.
Our next one comes from...
I'll fucking throw something at you.
Next one is Kenny Lamadou. They say, love the trade-off between the two hosts. 5 stars. I really enjoy how this couple switches off researching and hosting every other episode. Whoever hosts always presents a compelling and unbiased report. The co-hosts offer spot-on color commentary that I identify with, and the interrupts to ask the same questions that I would be asking if I was in the room listening to the host report the story. Y'all are awesome. Keep it up.
Thank you, Kenny Lamadou. I have a feeling that Shay is not pronouncing your name correctly, but if it is Lamadou, that's a pretty cool name, too. I don't want to be offensive, because what if it is Lamadou? Oh, no.
Every comment has to come after me in some way.
But thank you, Kenny. We appreciate it. I hope you continue to enjoy our episodes.
Kenda Joe says, everything's better in Texas. Love, love, love this podcast. I don't know why that's become a way to describe the podcast in review form, but everybody loves to start. Love, love, love. I don't even know how I came across this. It was a few days ago, but I'm so glad that I did. As an oil-filled service company owner, I spend a lot of time on the road and in the office doing paperwork. I turn on these two while I'm driving from location to location in the oil field and while I'm holed up in my office. It's so interesting to hear about cases from here in my home state and being able to know where they took place in. I also love the conversational tone of the show, and it never sounds scripted. It always sounds informative and detailed. I've been a fan for 3 days and have listened to a huge number of episodes. Hurry and put out more. Much love from the oil capital of Midland, Texas.
Oh, and Midland is about 4 hours away.
Yep.
I believe I looked into that for some reason recently.
It's close to Odessa. We have some friends that are moving there.
Boo.
Yeah. But hey, oil business is big out there. Thanks for listening. Tell all your oil people about us. And we love you guys.
Yeah. Tell them, send us over some of that oil money.
Or just some crude that we can sell on the black market.
Whatever's easier. Yeah. You know, that's just fine.
A rough barrel of crude oil from Midland. All right, last one.
Sure.
This one is by All Ears for Good Stuff. New to podcasts! Exclamation. From New Hampshire, I've recently begun listening to podcasts, and like everything in life, I go all in with a bunch of L's. I've listened... Was that an eagle? Or a hawk? It is a hawk. It's going... just like our weird theme music. It's weird. Okay.
Hawk, you're going to have to calm down. We're almost done with this episode.
Chill out, Hawk. I go all in with a bunch of L's. I've listened to some great podcasts, but I like that these are longer than some. Plus, you guys are affectionately animated. Nothing worse than people droning. Ugh. I have my headphones on 8 hours a day, and I'm an artist and a gardener and a dog gal. Oh my god, friggin' bird, shut up. And
what is going on out there?
I don't know. This bird has found a snake or something that it needs to alert the entire community
about. Is our
about.
Whole yard snakes?
Could be.
Is that why it won't shut up?
It's Texas. It could be.
True.
Apparently this person is an artist, a gardener, and a dog person. She also wants to let us know that you guys are great. Now, how about some stuff from other states? I love Texas, but lost at times. Please keep up the great stories and attitudes. Patty from New Hampshire. Well, Patty from New Hampshire, I don't know if you've done a lot of research into what this podcast is about, but this is a Texas true crime podcast specifically from Texans. We love podcasts from all over the world. We support them. You'll find our promotions in the show. But today, tomorrow, and for the foreseeable future, we're just covering Texas crime. Maybe we got a spinoff podcast?
Yeah, I was about to say, maybe we'll have 49 other spinoff podcasts, one for each other state in the union.
we'll start with New Hampshire.
Yeah, I was about to say, that'll be our next one.
Okay.
And we'll be sure to bring you on, whoever, what was the person's name?
That was All Ears for Good Stuff. Patty from New Hampshire.
And we will be sure, Patty, to bring you on episode number one. Thank you for being here in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we can get somebody from Old Hampshire who migrated to New Hampshire and did a murder for episode one.
Okay. You start that research. That'll be your episode for sure, Shay.
Anybody know where Old Hampshire is?
Where is Old Hampshire? But you know what? I'm sure you'll tell us all about it.
We're going to find out. All right. What are we calling this? Contiguous crimes? Is that what we're calling it? No, because that leaves out Alaska and Hawaii.
That's right. We don't. Well,
the
you know
state
what?
Of crime. Oh, I just nailed it. Every season's a new state.
Oh, that's actually a pretty good idea, huh?
Yeah. Boy, man, that opens up our research opportunities so hard because there's so many crimes I want to cover, but I like ferret them out and I'm like, oh, that's not in Texas. It just happens to have like a detective from Texas. That doesn't count.
Well, Peggy, you have given us something to think about.
All right. Well, this is the wrap-up stage, Aaron. Got anything else we need to cover? Get off our chests?
No.
I second that.
Sorry. I just got distracted by the fact that I'm thinking about ordering pizza.
All right. You guys go order pizza and we'll have it theoretically,
all
spiritually,
together.
And out of body experience pizza together. Is that weird?
Yeah.
You guys order a pizza while you're listening to this. Stop the episode. Wait for the last 30 seconds of this episode to air and eat your pizza with it. Nope. That's stupid, too.
All right. While Dork Novinsky over there decides the ins and outs of our pizza eating, I'm going to go ahead and say...
I'm Shea Butter.
Thank you for tuning in this week. And we will be back next week.
Or will we?
Seth Brett. You guys.
Always remember, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.